What's the message? Love is the message.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of Love is the Message. My name is Tim Lawrence and I'm here with Jeremy Gilbert.
Hello.
This is the second of 8 introductory episodes in which we highlight some of the key themes that we want to return to again and again during this podcast series. This episode is the first of 2 in which we're going to focus on counterculture. In the last episode, we looked at the way that counterculture was a specific historical formation in the late 1960s that brought together anti-war movement, civil rights, the feminist movement, gay liberation, and other radical movements into a coalition. And we also thought about the way in which counterculture also signifies a general opposition to the mainstream, the status quo conservative forces. What we wanted to do in this episode is spend a little bit more time thinking about what we might mean when we talk about countercultural music and countercultural scenes. And we're going to open by thinking about the late 1960s and early 1970s before we go on to think about a whole series of musical scenes and formations that are often thought of in terms of counterculture, including reggae, punk, house music, techno, drum and bass, and hip hop. Jeremy, just to get things going, can you share your thoughts on the way that music and counterculture started to come into a sort of mutual expression in the late 1960s and what forms this took?
Yeah, sure. So the most conventional sort of mainstream account of this is to do with the way in which rock music increasingly had a sense of itself as having some sort of a social mission in the late 60s. I mean, rock and roll had been associated with some sort of idea of rebellion, if only rebellion against sort of racially segregated society and the sexual repression of this mid-20th century. But then there's some this sort of amorphous sense that somehow rock was about changing the world. It was getting sort of stronger in the late 60s. And at the same time, there's this, you know, really significant growth in protest movements, in what sociologists would call the new social movements, sort of anti-racism, feminism, etc., around the same time. And so all these things are sort of converging. What's not talked about, at least in the most boring accounts, what's not talked about is that also in other areas of music, things are developing in some ways, in more obviously radical ways. So what's happening at the end of the 60s, the early 70s, is that the mainstream of the sort of soul music tradition, which is really a bit heavily influenced by the work of James Brown and other funk pioneers, is becoming increasingly politically self-conscious, increasingly experimental. Artists of themselves are becoming increasingly self-confident. There's, you know, people like Stevie Wonder are starting to get kind of the kind of studio time that the Beatles would have expected, etc. And whether or not those artists saw themselves as engaged in any sort of political project, they're certainly embraced by people who are influenced by ideas like Black Power. You could also say in a more amorphous sense, in a sense that isn't really going to have clear repercussions till sometime in the 70s, emerging tendencies like women's liberation and gay liberation are also, you know, they're part of a general questioning of the way in which people experience themselves, which is related to a really incredible fermentation of musical experimentation. Because I think one thing that's really clear is if you could like mathematically measure sort of rates of musical innovation, which I think you probably could, and I wouldn't know exactly how, the historical peak of music, of formal musical innovation across various genres would be sort of the early 70s. And I think these things are really deeply connected with each other. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, completely. I mean, absolutely. I suppose one of the interesting things is the extent to which musicians understood themselves to be sort of consciously part of a movement that was seeking societal change. Are there any particular musicians who you think became productively involved within this kind of struggle, if you like, seeing a correlation between cultural expression and wider political change?
It's important to say, you know, the idea of the counterculture is always a sort of hypothetical idea. I mean, people who are critical of the idea or critical of the effects of all these scenes and movements will always point out that, well, there never was any such thing as a counterculture. There were you know, lots of diverse tendencies that had lots of different conflicting agendas, which is all true. But I always say, well, look, that's true of any sort of historical moment. It's true of any scene. I mean, you can also say there's no such thing as punk, like if you want to start digging down into the very different ways in which people understood what was going on. But we have to acknowledge, yeah, it was always a sort of tendentious concept. And the name counterculture named a sort of desire for all of these things to somehow come together and take on a clearly explicit political sense of themselves, which probably only really existed in the minds of a few intellectuals like Allen Ginsberg, people like this. But in terms of musicians, we normally think of the epicenter of the counterculture at this time as really being Northern California, the sort of Bay Area. And certainly there were bands around there, people like the Grateful Dead, Country Joe and the Fish, to some extent people like Jefferson Airplane. They all saw themselves as part of some sort of generic social movement. Although I would say for the most part, if you'd sat them down and said, well, what is it you're in favour of? You'd have got some pretty vague answers about a sort of general shift in consciousness. And what the single thing they would have understood themselves to be most definitely opposed to is probably the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And a lot of people's responses to the question, like, what is it you're actually against at this moment, would really have depended on their interpretation of the causes of the Vietnam War and what it would mean to be against it. So there are people who had a really clear sense that what it meant to be against the Vietnam War was to be against American imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism. And then there were people whose sense of what it meant to be against the Vietnam War was to be more against a sort of general sense of the militarism and authoritarianism of American society. And those people might well think that the solution to those problems was to get everyone to take loads of acid rather than try to organize workers' revolution. And one of the things that makes the moment so compelling, but also so confusing, all those things are sort of coming together. And most of the musicians, there will be all kinds of exceptions to this, but as a general rule, you know, the sort of white musicians are probably mostly have a sort of pretty vague sense that they're against the man, they're against authority, they're against the state, they're against the war. And they probably do sort of mostly have the idea that if everybody can raise their consciousness with acid and get groovy, then things can change. And I would say, again, as a very rough cliche, probably the black musicians who have been engaged over the past few years in a very urgent and immediate struggle for civil rights and various sort of political and economic rights often, I think, have a more clear-sighted idea of like what it is they're up against, and what, because they understand that there's a sort of quite complex set of ways in which everyday life and everyday sort of prejudices are connected to institutions and are connected to sort of economic and social forms of power. So I think they're probably more articulate a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, whenever I think about counterculture or just allude to it, the thing that immediately comes to mind that seems to express the core of its sensibility, its ethos, is also partly this idea of the Rainbow Coalition. It was about a certain consciousness around transformation and the need to expand beyond societal limits and forms of repression and containment. And it seemed to be the very idea that groups needed to liberate themselves, but that they could also best liberate themselves if they share the struggle with other oppressed groups, that this somehow is what counterculture was supposed to be about. It's this cross-group movement consciousness. But that's quite challenging in a way, because, you know, it's easy to talk about the Rainbow Coalition, but to actually practice having all of these groups come together in a conversation simultaneously and to find a language that they can share is quite challenging. I mean, we're not going to spend too much of this week focusing on the Loft. We will come back to it in a little bit. But one of the things that David Mancuso did so successfully at the Loft, I think, is integrate so many different people from so many different backgrounds with so many different sounds that it becomes this kind of, perhaps for both of us, this ultimate expression of counterculture. In a way, it was a grand experiment. It hadn't really been tried before. So it's easy for us to look back on it and point to its limitations and its flaws and its contradictions and maybe its disappointments. But it is interesting to sort of also try and think through how, I mean, if we think about Woodstock briefly, and we could even think a bit about Hendrix potentially as well, and Hendrix's place within counterculture. If we think about Woodstock, you know, there was an attempt there, although it was kind of a festival that was largely led by white male rock musicians, there was clearly an attempt to bring in kind of a plurality of voices, whether it was female musicians, including Joan Baez, or groups such as Santana, Sly and the Family Stone, other global musicians. There was an attempt to have this musical happening capture what was going on in counterculture. I mean, how do you see something like Woodstock or something like the Grateful Dead managing to capture and articulate this idea of a rainbow coalition that is seeking global transformation?
So, I mean, it's really useful, that phrase, rainbow coalition. What's happening at Woodstock, what's happening in the late 60s, early 70s is, yeah, there's this much more incoherent sense that these strands all have something in common, or they should have something in common, and they should all come together. But exactly on what terms they're all going to come together, like around what project, on the basis of what shared values or shared identity they're going to come together, is really unclear. And to some extent, they don't manage to. And it sort of all becomes much more fragmented by the mid-70s. You're right that Woodstock, it's a really good point, actually. So Woodstock does sort of manifest this idea. I mean, it was talked about as a gathering of the tribes. You know, that was a kind of popular phrase. This idea that there were these tribes and they had to gather together on a common campsite was like a sort of a popular metaphor. But also, actually, when we were first planning this, like, we did a bit of research about Woodstock, and we were slightly surprised to realise that it had been so diverse. Because our cliched understanding of Woodstock was it was all white guys with guitars. And I think that's not entirely wrong, in that there was a sort of tension in that kind of Woodstock rock music formation, whereby on the one hand, you wanted to bring together all these radical energies of these different groups. On the other hand, if there was going to be a figure who could sort of speak for everybody, it was probably going to be some white guy. You know, it was probably Bob Dylan. And Hendrix himself is a really interesting figure. He can't really get popular in Britain, in America. So he goes to Britain, like at the height of swinging London, 66, 67. And he's a sort of honorary white rocker at the moment when the very idea of the white rock star is being invented. But then he himself is frustrated by that. He's frustrated by that in political terms, fairly explicitly, actually, because he himself goes through a period of kind of radicalization. He goes from being just a sort of hippie who's against the war and wants peace and love to being someone who's a bit more aware of having a certain responsibility to a black community and a project of black liberation. And also musically, towards the end of his life, he was a bit musically frustrated by the limits of sort of blues rock. You know, he was trying to play more jazz. He was scheduled to do some recording with Miles Davis, actually, which is one of the great lost opportunities of recent musical history. And I mean, it is a thing that's really relevant to thinking about the loft, because if there's a kind of problem with Woodstock, and the problem with that kind of Woodstock formation, it is this idea that, well, it's the white rock guys who is sort of, it's rock which is the universal musical language, rather than say like soul or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the loft, yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, the loft does sort of create an aesthetic there in New York, a kind of musical aesthetic, which somehow manages to exemplify the possibility of, as you say, of the sort of rainbow coalition, the sort of unity in difference from the mid-80s onward.
Music, dance, sound systems, counterculture. This is Love is the Message.
I just want to ask you a bit more about Hendrix, because I think you're absolutely right that you have musicians coming together, but the sound that is supposed to, you know, articulate counterculture does end up being reduced in some respects, certainly through the Woodstock prism, as being rock music. I mean, Hendrix, I kind of understood, you know, has deep roots in black music, and, you know, and especially in the blues, but as also in jazz, and in many ways saw himself as a jazz musician. But when he formed, you know, various bands that became kind of rock bands, he found that, you know, his audience kind of became constrained in a sense. For example, as you were sort of alluding to, the black, you know, the African-American audience wasn't really that interested in his kind of psychedelic style. So we can create this idea that, you know, psychedelics, rock music, an openness to music kind of ran through the late 1960s and was captured by, you know, a musician like Hendrix. But Hendrix himself was kind of finding it hard to express a blues and jazz style within the rock framework. And at the same time, there's one argument is that his black audience also wasn't really interested in his psychedelic style.
Interesting to pinpoint what's going on aesthetically. I think you're right. Because really what's happening at that moment in the second half of the 60s, one of the things that's happening is the blues of basically a previous generation of blues musicians, people like Howlin' Wolf, are being sort of canonized by these white musicians like the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton. Whereas the black audience, for the most part, has sort of completely moved on from this stuff. And it's not really interested in the aesthetic, the post-war blues aesthetic, which is much more about an experience of urban alienation. You know, they're much more want the kind of more militant or more optimistic sort of sound. And so I think it's the blues rock element of the Jimi Hendrix experience, which doesn't really connect with black audiences. But what black audiences are still, a lot of them, really interested in is jazz. And it's jazz that he really wants to go into. And it's the fact that there is all this really interesting experimentation with jazz going on.
Indeed, Hendrix is this interesting pivotal figure around which the pivot isn't entirely working, I suppose we could say. He's pivotal in terms of wanting to bring together elements of blues and rock and jazz. I mean, we have kind of Gil Scott-Heron very soon afterwards starts to do a similar kind of thing. But Hendrix was interested in doing these things, and what he wanted to do sounded like a perfect expression and articulation of counterculture. And yet there was a struggle in the ground with audiences in terms of bringing everyone together around this shared idea, if you like, shared practice. I mean, the Woodstock is this really interesting example of where Hendrix started to work with more African-American and Latin American musicians in this band, the Gypsy Sons and the Rainbows. It was this band that gave Hendrix's performance at Woodstock kind of a lot of its polyrhythmic strength and dynamism. But then when the film came out of Woodstock, the sound that was used basically erased the band. So once again, Hendrix was being cast within a kind of straight up rock mode that didn't correlate, didn't reflect what he was trying to do musically. This was in the film of Woodstock. So it's really interesting the way these things quickly got institutionalized as a festival that was trying to be inclusive and outward looking. And of course, it's not like the filmmakers wouldn't have wanted that, but the sound got to be condensed into something that was much more formally around kind of rock and with a psychedelic edge. And it was that very psychedelic edge that at times Hendrix couldn't kind of communicate to his black audience in the United States, as you were suggesting. Can we think about another, you know, some more music that somehow captures also what this moment is about musically from the perspective of a white rock act, where there are elements, you know, not only of trying to embrace rock music itself, but also bringing in elements of folk, which were clearly central to not only the emergence of civil rights, but also folk music sort of seeking wider, you know, the wider struggle of, you know, societal transformation. Can you think of some bands that managed to bring together these elements within a kind of white rock folk context?
I mean, the seminal band that did that is the Byrds, but I think the track we're going to listen to is the Youngbloods, who were more of a sort of one-hit wonder. So one of the sort of anthems, the sort of it's really the American equivalent of the Beatles' "All You Need Is Love," the sort of Summer of Love anthem, is this song by the Youngbloods, "Get Together," bringing this sort of folk and pastoral element, which has already been part of the sort of ingredients of the counterculture, because folk music was so important to the protest scene of the early 60s. And it's fusing it more with the sort of rock sound in a way that people like the Byrds had already started to pioneer, and which in some ways was widely... if you'd asked people in sort of 67, 68, like, what is that sort of California sound? A lot of them would have assumed you meant sort of folk rock. And of course, the lyric is this kind of very famous kind of big choral lyric. Come on, everybody, smile on your brother. Obviously, it's your brother, not your brother and sister. But it's interesting as well as expressing a sentiment, because in some ways, it's expressing a perspective on that issue that we've already touched upon about, well, how do you bring everybody together? And its proposal is that you bring everybody together by having a very kind of innocuous, almost a sort of Christian-derived, sort of universalistic sense of unity and peace and love, which sort of imagines the differences, you know, political differences, ethnic differences, class differences, whatever, can be sort of dissolved if there's just a sort of political or moral will to do so. And I think, to some extent, the notion of counterculture actually really gets going about a year after this, at the moment when people start to realise, well, that isn't really going to work. You can tell everybody to love each other, but A, there are differences and issues that need to be worked out. But B, if you just tell everybody to love each other and, you know, drop out and don't go fight in the war, then the police are going to come and put you in prison. The National Guard is going to shoot you. So you've got to sort of, and if you're black, you know, they're going to do that, you know, with a far greater alacrity than if you're white. So it's a sort of beautiful track, and it's sort of a beautiful, expresses a beautiful sentiment. But it also, I mean, like the Beatles, All You Need Is Love, that I think we talked about last time, it sort of marks a limit point, really, at which, in particular, it marks a point at which a certain cohort of sort of middle-class white people, young people, who are the absolute beneficiaries of the post-war welfare state and the expansion of the universities and the expansion of professional employment and the liberation, the loosening and liberalizing of sexual mores, that have been beneficiaries of all this. But they're about to come up against the fact that, you know, when they ask the question, you know, why can't we just all have less hang-ups? Why can't we have a less repressive society? Why do we have to murder people in Vietnam? They're going to come up against the fact that there is an answer to that question. And the answer to that question is because there are some very, very powerful people in institutions who don't want those things to change in the way they would like them to. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another.
That's really interesting, Jeremy, what you say about this moment around 1967, especially when bands thought that it might be enough to say all you need is love, or get together and let's love one another. Can you describe some of the events that happen within a pretty short space of time, within the next couple of years, that start to provide some sort of reality check, if you like, to this very nascent countercultural movement?
Well, the most obvious things to say are the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and Nixon winning the election in 68. Those, I mean, they're in the States at least. I mean, that is the big reality check. I mean, Bobby Kennedy, who it's very hard to say what was actually going on with Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's younger brother, but he was going for the Democratic nomination for president. He was the favorite to win it. And he seemed to have undergone some fairly authentic sort of radicalization, like partly as a consequence of the murder of his brother and his sort of attempt to find out what the background to that was. And also just because, you know, large sections of his whole generation were being radicalized. And it looked very likely he was going to become president at the end of 68. And if he had, it's very likely he would not have done what Nixon did, which was to sort of draw a line under the period of the post-war expansion of the welfare state, the liberalization of society, that he would have, you know, he would have continued to expand the welfare state, he would have continued to redistribute wealth, and he would quite likely have ended the war. Mm. And then Martin Luther King, I mean, I think everybody listening is going to know about that. Martin Luther King is assassinated. He himself had told friends he expected to be assassinated, and he's assassinated because he has been going around saying, it's not enough just to let black people vote. You've got to redistribute wealth and power to them if they're going to have decent lives. So there's that. You know, and then Nixon winning the election instead of a progressive Democrat winning the election. But I would also say part of the underlying context to it all, from, if you like, a sort of vulgar Marxist perspective, is that one of the things that's going on in Britain and the States is this is the end of the long post-war economic boom. Unemployment is starting to return to the industrial regions, places like Detroit and Birmingham, for the first time since World War II. And that is one of the things that's underscoring all this, is that on an economic perspective, what you've had from the end of World War II, and in America, what you've had from the moment of the New Deal in 1932, through to the end of the 60s is a sort of governmental consensus which says that, well, what government has to maintain full employment, maintain an economic regime which allows wages to keep growing, so oversee a continual expansion of the public sector, oversee a continual expansion of education. So the people born in the 40s and 50s are the first generation in history, really, of whom a large numbers of them, and in many cases a majority, expect to have a job for life. They expect to go to university without it costing them too much. They expect to have kind of very fulfilled kind of personal lives, you know, as well as an unprecedented level of consumer affluence. Even though only a few economists are kind of really conscious that this is starting to come to an end between 67 and 68, it is that we can now look back and say, well, that is actually the exact moment when all that comes to an end, and it never, ever comes back. So that's part of it as well. I mean, that's part of what the fact that you can't, I mean, from the point of view of things like civil rights, you know, the state is going to have less money to spend. Employers are going to have less money, not more money. So they're suddenly, so quite fairly suddenly, they're much, much less interested in political demands, which are going to cost them money. And they're much more looking around and thinking, well, we have to do something to suppress these growing demands from young people, women, black people, etc., for a form of life which isn't really compatible with sort of profitable capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, I think that's all very true. I wonder if, like, capital's kind of concerted response to the challenge of the slowdown in the economy that started to become apparent in the late 1960s, but accelerated more in the 1970s. I wonder if that kind of response took greater root, if you like, in the 1970s. I'm not entirely sure, but certainly there was my sense is that in the late 1960s, part of the state response to counterculture and part of capital's response to counterculture was to see it as a unprecedented and direct threat on its position of power. There was a genuine concern, wasn't there, that there were these movements and that these movements might recognize that they could unite, and that something like the simple consumption of an emerging drug like acid could have a profound impact on someone's view of their place in the world and could lead to questioning. Timothy Leary became this somewhat erratic, somewhat or very egotistical spokesperson for acid counterculture, and became a target for the way that it was seen to be being handled in an irresponsible way. But at that particular moment, there was a real sense of the possibility of transformational change, in particular around this drug. So, even, you know, the suppression, the fact that LSD was made illegal was, you know, a major part of the state's kind of fight back to kind of secure its kind of authority.
Well, you're right. It's worth quickly just being specific about the details there. So in the early 60s, LSD is just seen as this basically benign, sort of interesting new chemical, which all kinds of very respectable people are experimenting with. You know, it's like playing a computer game or something. It's not like a really radical thing to do. And then what happens is some of the people, indeed people like Leary, become convinced that if you can get everybody taking acid, it will completely change the world. But they see it more in the sense of a sort of religious movement. You know, it's like early Christianity or something, and they want everybody to take acid. But they think if everybody takes acid, what they'll do and what they advise them to do is, in Leary's words, tune in, turn on, drop out. People will stop participating in the rat race. They'll stop wanting to consume as aggressively as they have. And of course, the capitalist economy completely depends on domestic consumption at this time. I mean, that does really terrify the authorities. I mean, it does provoke a moral panic. And in fact, in like around 65, 66, the reactions you're getting from different sections of the press and the political class are quite interesting, because on the right, there's a resurgence of the political right going on from 64 onwards, really. I mean, they absolutely hate it, and they hate Leary, and there's a real sort of panic. There's also this slight mystification from a lot of liberals about, well, why would you panic about this? These kids are just preaching peace and love. It's just Christian morals. Like, why would you even care about it? But I think it only really starts to be seen as a real threat when the acid movement is seen as sharing some interests and concerns with the anti-Vietnam War movement. There's a certain language of pacifism. There's a whole history of pacifism, which has antecedents in things like Quakerism, which is part of the anti-war movement. And it's that, and it's the fact that the war in Vietnam is so central to the kind of political and economic projects of the American political class, of Democrats and Republicans mostly, at that time, means they criminalize LSD. They start to become really repressive towards it. And some of the most, you know, people like J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, I mean, they increasingly think that this is a real threat to the whole American way of life, which might weaken America in its global struggle against communism. And that's the story. The story they tell themselves is they're hippies. You know, they're going to get everybody dropping out and taking acid when they should be, you know, training hard on the football pitch, you know, defending their right to drive their Buicks with their lives. And because that's what they see is motivating people actually to participate in the global military struggle against communism. And so they're really worried. But it's only after that repression really comes down that, for example, Leary gets politicized. Like, Leary is basically anti-politics until sort of 68. And then once he himself has become literally, I think the FBI literally put him at the top of the most, you know, sort of public enemy list at some stage. Or there's some list that Hoover has got, whether it's public or not, I'm not sure, which has Leary at the top as like the person they most want to get. Then Leary becomes politicized and he starts to say, actually, you know, we need revolution. You know, we can't or just drop out. And that is sort of the moment, the high moment of counterculture, I think.
You're listening to Love is the Message with Tim Lawrence and Jeremy Gilbert.
Enjoying the show? If you can, please consider supporting what we do via our Patreon so we can stay free. You can find the link in the show notes. Thanks, and back to the show.
At the end of the decade, you know, at the end of the 60s, this decade that gets so heavily associated with counterculture, there's the sense that there are internal tensions, some might even say contradictions within counterculture that start to manifest themselves. So in part, there's this pressure from the state to repress some of the more radical challenges that are being channeled through counterculture. But then at the same time, there's this element within counterculture, which is about freedom, is about creativity, is about dynamism, is about pursuing new forms of expression. And in some respects, those ideas and energies can be all directed towards a form of egalitarian and communal society. And then on the other hand, they can also be utilized to promote one's own situation, one's power, one's, you know, economic wealth. So it was at Altamont in, you know, this pop festival in San Francisco, December 1969, that was supposed to be one of the high points of counterculture, but ends up becoming this place where there's some violence, a couple of members of the audience die, and the Rolling Stones, it was a free concert, but then it turned out that the Rolling Stones were having the concert filmed and that the film was going to be sold and marketed for the purposes of profit. And so this is one of these moments where fans of the Rolling Stones, who saw, you know, Mick Jagger and the rest of the band as these mouthpieces, these voices of counterculture and radicalism, and are putting on concerts for free, then find ways to put this exercise to personal profit. When we look back on this today, it looks like an incredibly mild thing to do. This is one of the ways where, you know, people within counterculture see an opportunity to make money. And it creates a sense of disappointment and frustration. And this comes in, you know, even before the decade is out. This is becoming something that counterculture has to kind of grapple with constantly, this balance between collectivity and individual benefits and money-making profits.
Yeah, it's always the issue with the understanding the history of the counterculture, because there's a standard account of that history, which is still reproduced by people like Adam Curtis today, which says that really it was all about a sort of nihilistic individualism. It was really just about people rejecting any form of traditional morals or authority and just wanting to do their own thing. And there were definitely strands of that. I mean, a certain kind of libertarian individualism was part of sort of California culture and had been for decades. But it's also clear that that wasn't what most people involved thought they were doing at all. In fact, most people involved thought they were protesting against what they saw as the soulless individualism and materialism of capitalist consumer culture. And
absolutely.
I mean, we'll talk about this loads more over the next... Well, we'll keep talking about this forever, I think. But, I mean, essentially, the bits of the counterculture which are allowed to survive and prosper into the 70s and 80s and 90s by their political enemies are those which just encourage people to be individual, self-expressive consumers. And the bits that aren't allowed to prosper are really the bits which are about promoting a notion of solidarity and, you know, the rejection of capitalist values. I mean, in terms of the Stones and Altamont, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, the Stones... I mean, Mick Jagger, I've always been told this as an anecdote. I don't know if it's true, but Jagger was like a member of a Trotskyist organization for like 1 year in 68 and then just got bored of it after a year and started his journey towards becoming indeed, as I understand it, the sort of Ayn Rand libertarian, you know, neoliberal that he's been for a long time.
Mm.
But then I would say for the most part, you know, the band, the British musicians at that moment, the ones who were famous, like hardly any of them had any politics. I mean, the exception would be maybe Pink Floyd and Roger Waters. But, you know, the Stones never really had any politics. The Beatles never really had any politics. I mean, people will get angry at me saying this, but John Lennon, you know, John Lennon's politics were confused at best. And it was an interesting contrast with actually the West Coast bands did have a lot more kind of self-conscious politics, I think. I suppose the exemplary instance in relation to what you're talking about is the Grateful Dead, because, you know, the Grateful Dead, did I talk about this all? No, I was talking to this to our students about this. I wasn't talking on the show. Really, in terms of what you're talking about, the issue of commodification and the Stones wanting to make a saleable commodity out of the recording the concert, the thing that the Grateful Dead become really famous for in subsequent years and decades is encouraging their fans to make tapes of their shows and then circulate them for free. When most artists, including like former countercultural icons like Bob Dylan, had been totally opposed to this, they'd seen it as theft of their intellectual property, and they, you know, security firms got hired specifically to stop people making bootleg recordings at concerts. It became a part of rock culture. And the Grateful Dead, you know, I'm always saying this to people that, you know, the British and European audiences, I mean, maybe less so places like Germany, but British audiences never really get the significance of the Grateful Dead in the States. The Grateful Dead were never massively popular in Britain, and they're seen as this slightly embarrassing band, you know, partly because people listen to the studio albums, a lot of which are fairly bland sort of country rock. But the Grateful Dead in America became the absolute iconic band of the counterculture. And really, the Grateful Dead and its fandom, if you like, became an entire culture in itself over the course of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And the Grateful Dead, what they were famous for live was doing these kind of extended improvisation. They wrote these kind of honky-tonk sort of blues rock songs, which they played on the studio albums. But then live, they would use those as the template for basically extended improvisation, pretty much the way in which somebody like Coltrane would use, you know, the Great American Songbook, jazz standards as the basis for these big improvisations. So they were playing a kind of jazz. I've always said it's a sort of jazz. And one person who definitely observed that, who thought that what the Grateful Dead were doing were playing a kind of jazz and saw that they were reaching this big youthful audience through that was, you know, at least according to legend, was Miles Davis, who by that point in his career was a great, you know, was very, very well established as like one of the iconic figures of 50s and 60s jazz. But he was always frustrated by how niche his audience was. Miles was always frustrated by the fact that despite being recognized as one of the great musicians of the century, like, he didn't have anything like the audience of people like the Beatles or even a Dylan. And I think the story is it was after a Grateful Dead show at the Fillmore that he decided to start incorporating electric instruments and to experiment with bringing in electric guitar and some electric keyboards and some kind of electric and psychedelic effects into jazz. And that's the basis for the kind of early, I mean, they're sometimes referred to as fusion, but it's almost, fusion is the kind of name for the sort of synthesis of jazz and rock, which becomes popular under the influence of these records later in the 70s. But they're sort of too, formally, they're not quite rock enough to be fusion. They are sort of electric jazz. That is the basis for this series of albums that Miles records, beginning with In a Silent Way in 69. You know, an incredible series of albums, and the probably the most famous of which is 1970s Bitches Brew. So maybe, do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, well, I was also going to say that there's, I'm not entirely sure of the dates when the Grateful Dead appear at the Fillmore East and also Miles Davis, but I know that both lineups artists played there. And one of the things about it was that the lineups could be mixed. But also the audiences were mixed. New York City had a very, very mixed population at that time. And there were lots of parts of the city where you could go into, you know, public places, go into concert venues, and you could kind of bring this kind of mixed crowd together. And this is, and Miles Davis kind of went on record for being publicly appreciative of the way that, you know, the crowd was all mixed up and different groups of people were coming to see him. He said, kind of thought this was good for everybody. The fact that these audiences were, you know, listening to the Grateful Dead and were listening to him and listening to anyone else who was kind of appearing. And I think that this also brings to the fore some of the kind of urgent questions that African Americans had for counterculture. I mean, one of the slogans which we dropped a little bit earlier or mentioned a little bit earlier was to tune in and to drop out, as Timothy Leary, demand or suggestion, proposal. But it was a lot easier to drop to tune in and drop out if you were kind of already sort of relatively privileged.
Yeah, ideally with a trust fund, yeah.
Yeah, so you couldn't really drop out of something unless you were kind of, if you weren't part of it in the first place. If you're already the kind of outsider, then how could you drop out? You just kind of drop out further, really. And I think that this was the kind of conundrum faced by, you know, many black musicians. We talked about Hendrix, but I think Miles Davis, as you're already touching on, kind of experienced spiritually or psychically or even kind of in a material way, the idea that he could be this extraordinary kind of innovator within jazz music, and yet felt that he wasn't getting the same kind of recognition, the same kind of acknowledgements and benefits that were being enjoyed by musical peers who happened to be white rather than black. I think Miles said, Miles's kind of whole thing was that he never wanted to accept anyone else's idea of what he should sound like. This was why he was the kind of, you know, the great innovator of certainly the 1960s within jazz music. I think in the 1968 that he sort of said, there was a quote from him that was, he said that his favorite music is Stockhausen, Tosca and James Brown. It's about bringing these different sounds and these different elements together, which creates the sense of a world which, you know, which is greater than the one that everyone was currently sharing. So it's bringing these sounds together, but also it's the practice in which these sounds were recorded in the first place. It was about freedom of expression. And so, again, this was Miles Davis's way of kind of leading these sessions that I think he said everyone adds and everyone responds. Sometimes you subtract, take away rhythm and leave just the high sound, or take out what you know belongs to someone else and keep the feeling. He added, what my musicians have got to do is extend themselves beyond what they think they can do. And this idea of extending yourself beyond what you think you can do, that's something about counterculture. There's a spirit there of potentiality.
Expanding consciousness.
We don't always kind of think of Miles Davis as being kind of a countercultural figure as such, but maybe that's because we're more habituated at thinking about white rock musicians as being the symbolic figures of counterculture. But what you say about the Grateful Dead is, you know, I agree with, and it's all very compelling, but we also have this kind of practice gets to be developed and expressed within Bitches Brew. What's your take on the album, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, I agree with all of that. And I mean, I could add bits. I mean, the actual record isn't a kind of live recording. It's a tape, sort of a tape collage put together by the producer, Teo McCarron. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it's one of the really early experiments, along with Cannes, actually, in Germany a year or so later, taping together a sort of tape collage of extended jam sessions being a way of producing sound. And it's obviously related in some ways to what the dub producers are doing, what George Martin was doing with the Beatles. So in all those ways, it's
just Stockhausen as well, I guess.
Yeah, Stockhausen. I mean, Stockhausen is who Can learned it directly from, and I guess who Teo McCarron is learning from. Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Mm. Without music, life would be a mistake.
Hello, this is Matt. I produce the show. We're making this podcast because we believe that alternative history and radical ideas should be given as much airtime as possible. Yet it's increasingly difficult for knowledge of this kind to circulate through the mainstream media or university sector. We love doing it, and we're committed to making sure it's available for free to anyone who wants it. But at the end of the day, for myself, Jeremy and Tim, this is what we do for our jobs. This kind of work isn't just a hobby, and we've each permanently lost a significant chunk of our regular income due to the pandemic. We won't be able to carry on doing this without some financial support, so if you have the means and you like what we're doing, please consider supporting us via our Patreon. You can find the link in the show notes. Thanks.
I think it's just worth saying, you know, Bitches Brew was recorded and released, I think, in 1970. And obviously it was recorded in New York City. You know, I have no reason to believe that Miles Davis ever went to the Loft, but there are similar energies going on here with this idea to challenge kind of establishment conventions and to find different ways of organizing the way that people can come together through sound. I suppose the thing that interests us is the way that you look across society, you look in these places, it's within music that some of the most compelling and dynamic expressions of how we can live in new ways comes to the fore. I guess we both enjoy watching films and TV and are interested maybe in cooking. And, you know, there are all these things that form part of our lives that we love to do. But music is somehow becomes this place where something more extraordinary and transformational can take place. I mean, I guess, you know, this is something we might discuss in future episodes. But it's that experience of having sound waves enter into your body and change your experience of your place in the world, often in association with other people, not just musicians, but people dancing or people listening, that enables music to be this place of possibility. And so there may not be any direct connection, but in 1970, you have Miles Davis recording Bitches Brew and you have David Mancuso opening The Loft. And it's not to try and draw a facile connection, but just to say both of these visions are about how do you increase the potentiality of us to lead fulfilling lives as human beings.
I mean, you could probably say as well that, like, you know, actual political organisations and institutions have yet to actually, we've yet to find ways of creating a forms of politics that can completely actualize that sort of vision is the wrong word, the kind of experience of possibility that those sonic experiments create. But that's partly why I think it's still such a potent moment, and why being really interested in, quite invested in sort of music and musical experiments from that moment for me is not an act of nostalgia. It's about kind of remaining sort of connected to what's still to the, after 50 years, like one of the most powerful sources of inspiration.
I mean, if we're staying in 1970, which I think we should do, because, you know, what a great year to spend time in. But if we think about these different forces that are coming through in that particular year, then we've also got Gil Scott-Heron recording The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen.
So it's extraordinary to proto-hip-hop. Gil Scott-Heron, he's using sort of jazz funk. He's using the sort of emphatic urgency of James Brown's funk with a slightly more cerebral, slightly more, in some ways, kind of energetic sort of jazz sensibility, which is something it shares with a lot of the music we've been talking about today. But then this kind of rap over the top, I mean, a rap, it's a kind of spoken word poem, is this incredibly powerful critique of, you know, mass consumer culture, mass-mediated consumer culture, this critique of what Guy Debord in the 60s called the society of the spectacle. You know, the slogan sort of says it all, the revolution will not be televised. It's his invocation to his listeners to achieve a certain level of political consciousness and not to allow themselves to be sort of narcotized by mass media culture. And of course, that is a big concern for black radicals in particular in the first half of the 70s. A big concern is that actual drugs which we now know were to some extent being filtered into the ghettos via the mafia by the American security services, would serve to kind of dull the emerging revolutionary spirit of African-American people and their allies and comrades. And, but also this feeling that the danger of this kind of emerging consumer culture, which was that it would really prevent people from really recognizing, what the real sources of their oppression were and do something about it. So yeah, it's incredible, and it's still like really danceable. It's still really danceable. There's still a record you can put on and people will dance to it if you're DJing.
Tune in, turn on, get down. Love is the message.
I mean, it's one of the first attempts to really declare for the politicization of funk, which is always a really interesting development, because James Brown himself had pretty conservative politics. I mean, he was fairly anti-political and not really that sympathetic to sort of revolutionary black politics. And there was 3 or 4 years in the early 70s when he claimed to be a supporter of organizations like the Panthers, but I think it's mainly because he was under so much pressure to do that, because whatever he thought of it, funk was adopted by the Black Power movement, for example, as its music. The Black Panthers had a house band called the Lumpin', which played sort of heavy funk. And so the idea of funk as not just about sort of escaping your daily problems on the dance floor, but about really expressing a sense of political urgency in the urgency of the rhythm, in the urgency of the beat. This is a very, very explicit example of somebody of that being done, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there was this, the Black Panthers were really interested in kind of how culture could help certain political demands be forwarded. I think it was the Minister of Culture was kind of, Ed Bullins was arguing that militant artists need to concentrate on establishing contact with audiences that it wouldn't normally reach. There's this idea that, theatrical audiences were the audiences that many people within counterculture were kind of hoping to access. Classic theatrical audiences, literary audiences, established musical audiences. The Black Panther kind of goal was to reach people who didn't exist in these audiences, really, to effectively politicize them through culture. Working people, people who are, members in a gang, people who are, prostitutes, street people. It's like there was this concern with how do you kind of activate the consciousness of these people. Each individual in the crowd should have his sense of reality confronted, his consciousness assaulted. This was kind of the Black Panther kind of take on what culture should be doing. Reality confronted, consciousness assaulted. And this is what, this is what Gil Scott-Heron is doing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There's a real sort of tension in that scene at the time, actually, as to what they think of even someone like Miles Davis, never mind sort of hippies like the Grateful Dead, because there definitely is a hard-edged wing of the Panthers and their movement that was completely dismissive of all that stuff and saw it as just escapism. And would have seen Miles Davis as just producing a sort of connoisseur, music for rich hippies, be they black or white. But that wasn't as completely uniform a view as people might now often think. I mean, one thing we haven't really mentioned actually is there's this history from 67 to sort of the early 70s. There is a history of deliberately organized sort of conferences at which people from these different strands of the counterculture try to come together. So famously, the Black Panthers representative at the Dialectics of Liberation conference in London in 1967 ended up berating the audience for being a bunch of complacent white liberals. But then in the early 70s, I should have made a note of this actually, you should check, but there was a famous sort of convention, a sort of big conference organized by the Panthers and other smaller radical groups. And one of the famous lines from I think it's the minutes or the report of this conference comes out of a discussion about drugs. And they agree on a classification of drugs as either life drugs or death drugs. And so the death drugs are like heroin, cocaine, speed, etc. But they agreed that LSD and marijuana could be classified as life drugs, although they advise against overusing them once revolutionary consciousness has been achieved.
Well, that might take a while, right? So,
yeah. Who knows if you've got your consciousness revolutionary enough? But I think, personally, I'd say that's very sound advice, actually.
Join us next week for part 2 on Counterculture, where we'll be looking at reggae, punk, house, and hip-hop.